This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and there's a new sheriff in town. For the first time in a quarter century, Bristol County has a new corrections chief. Former Attleboro Mayor Democrat Paul Heroux narrowly beat out incumbent Republican Thomas Hodgson in November's sheriff elections. The race drew national attention, mostly because of Hodgson's reputation for hardline tactics on immigration, prisoner treatment, and criminal justice. Now, central to Hodgson's notoriety was New Bedford's Ash Street Jail. That's a 135-year-old lockup where Hodgson imposed a management style that some might have called old school and his opponents often characterized as medieval. People held at the jail say they spent all but a few hours per day in their cells and paid expensive fees for things like calling home. And then there were deaths by suicide, close to two dozen total in Bristol County lockups during Hodgson's tenure. The new sheriff, Paul Heroux, campaigned on a promise to overhaul Ash Street Jail as part of his proposal, and since becoming sheriff, he's put forth the idea of closing it all together. Sheriff Heroux joins us now on the line. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So I want to start with Ash Street, because, I mean, that's what we were just leading with. Did you know that you were likely to want to shut it down altogether? I mean, we've heard it called, for example, from former Sheriff David Nelson, Dickensian, but you've said actually conditions themselves are not what you expected when you visited it.
That's right. So I toured the facility for the first time late December, and the facility was very old. It wasn't quite dirty like I had heard about, but it was certainly very old, and I don't think it's suitable for modern corrections and modern programming, and just the programming needs that we have for the inmates are not adequately addressed at this facility for a lot of different reasons. But I never campaigned on closing the facility. I never made that pledge that I would actually do it, because I recognize that there's a reason for everything, and sometimes I might be causing more problems than I'm solving, or I might be creating more problems than I'm solving. But once I found out what the issue was with why we couldn't just move the inmates from Ash Street to the Dartmouth campus, Ash Street's in New Bedford and Dartmouth, the main campus is in Dartmouth, it was basically the 100 inmates that we have, the 100 inmates we have at Ash Street, they all need to be in a single cell for different reasons.
So, I'm going to stop you there just because there's a lot there that you and I know, but our listeners might not. So we're going to break this down with some sort of short questions to follow up on what you just said, and you can give me kind of quick answers and we'll move through that piece. So first, what you're saying in part is it's just not the effective way to house 100 prisoners and support them in criminal justice transition back into basically rehabilitation. Yes?
That's correct. And for a couple of reasons. One of them is that this is a 200,000 square foot building that requires a lot of maintenance. So just for basic administrative issues and costs alone, that would be a good reason to move away from this. But then
you
to your point—
You said $10,000 roughly just in gas and electric utilities per month in the winter.
I think that's about right, yeah. The and just in terms of programming for inmates, that the programming needs are inadequate. The inmates are getting a lot more program hours per week in Dartmouth than they are at Ash Street.
Okay.
We just don't, yeah.
All right.
And then there's also, you could argue there's a third reason, and that's just the overall conditions of confinement. You know, this is just an old jail. It sort of has a demoralizing effect on the people who might be locked up there, although some people prefer to be there because they have single cells. But like I said, I would like to retrofit some of our space here to have single cells here on this campus.
So let's be clear for listeners about that. What you're talking about is a facility at the Dartmouth campus that was used when there was a contract for detention with ICE, for ICE detainees. And as I understand it, it's designed for congregate detention, right? Multiple people in a space, whereas at Ash Street, most of the people who are being housed there are pre-trial, right? These are not, some are convicted of a crime, but most are pre-trial. They have separate cells, and you would need to retrofit the Dartmouth facility to accommodate that. Is that right?
That's right. And actually, I've moved away from the idea of because I found a cheaper way to do this. Instead of using the old ICE detention center and retrofitting that to be 100 cells, that cost would be a lot greater than if we retrofit one of the gymnasiums that is just being kind of mothballed right now. It would be a lot cheaper to do that for a lot of different reasons. So but basically, instead of retrofitting one area of the campus, we'll retrofit a different area at a cheaper cost. But just to be clear, I'm no longer looking at retrofitting the ICE detention center. We found a cheaper way to do it.
So who would pay for it?
It would be the state. So this is the Bristol County Sheriff's Office. It's the office of the sheriff, and I'm independently elected. So this is not a state department. However, almost all of our funding comes from the state. You know, we have a line in the state budget. And so this would be something that we'd have to do with the state, because all this, even though it's a Bristol Sheriff's Office, it's state property. So I'm the steward of the property.
And who, there's so much to talk to you about. So who in the state has to say yes to this, and what have you heard from them so far?
We need to get the yes from the state house in terms of the state House of Representatives and the state Senate and the governor. It starts with a feasibility study looking, and that would be done with DCAM, Division of Capital Asset Management, to find out if the idea that I have is even feasible. So I'd like to do this, but this, I cannot do it alone. I need the governor. I need the state house, both the Senate and the representatives. And we need all three to be in agreement to do this. But it would quickly pay for itself in terms of costs, what we're spending at Ash Street versus how much we'll spend here. So the initial upfront investment is going to be a little bit pricey, but it will pay for itself over the course of just several years. It would not take long to pay for itself.
And quick last question on that. Mm-hmm. Am I understanding that you would like the state to pay for it, or is this a case, and the Bristol County Sheriff's budget could not pay for it, at least without sacrificing other things. Is that the case, or is this a case where the only way it can get done is if the state will spend money on it? Do you understand the distinction of my question?
I do. And the state really needs to be involved with a project of this magnitude. So I could probably retrofit something on a small scale. We could probably absorb that cost with our existing budget and with, you know, our in-house maintenance crew. But a project of this magnitude is in the millions of dollars, and it would require, state funding. Otherwise, I mean, I have a $57 million budget, and for me to take a big chunk of that away, you know, this project that I'm guessing would be between $5 and $7 million, to take that money away would just really harm the rest of the operations.
Okay, so we went into a lot of the nuts and bolts there, Sheriff Harrell. But now let's talk about you and your reform agenda. You're a new sheriff in Bristol County for the first time in 25 years. You heard in my lead in here all of the sort of the history on Thomas Hodgson. One of the things that is very much on my mind is mental health care, especially given the history of what if one uses death by suicide as a metric, is observably poor mental health support for inmates in the Bristol County jails. Where is the most important change there, and how do you intend to do that?
Well, I'll talk about something very specific and then a little bit more global. Just this week, I signed a contract with a corrections suicide expert named Lindsay Hayes. He is nationally recognized as one of the country's leading experts on suicide. He's looked at over 3,800 suicides in prisons over the course of his career. And so we just decided to, I hired him because they've been referred to me several times. So we have a blind spot here in Bristol County. I'm not sure what that is. I don't know if anybody knows what that is, but that's why I retained Lindsay Hayes to look at this for us. So specific to the issue of suicide, that is something that I'm addressing right away. Just more global, more broadly speaking about inmate care and inmate services, I am going to be creating a new position and hiring somebody who I'm going to call the Director of Inmate Services. And this is going to be equal to somebody who's the CFO or the Chief of Staff or the Superintendent in terms of responsibility and, you know, like pay and just, you know, how many staff are under them. So it's going to be somebody who is probably used to work in a hospital, like run a hospital or a hospice or like an adult daycare. It's somebody who has a background in medical, like overseeing medical, mental health, food, education services. And, you know, this is who I'm going to basically task with addressing the needs of the inmates, whether they're medical, food, anything to do with needs of inmates.
And while we're talking about death by suicide, I do want to say for listeners, if you or someone you love is in mental health crisis or considering hurting themselves, you can call or text the National Mental Health Crisis Hotline at 988. It's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So I'll come back. I want to hit something a little bit touchy here, Sheriff Heroux, which is just before, and this has been litigated by the voters, you won, right? But just before, there was a report that came up from the State Department of Labor Relations about two violations in 2020 in your relationships to, and just basically verbal interactions with the firefighters union over the question of whether particular COVID cases could be considered injuries on the job and therefore people would get health care from those. Again, that part has been discussed. However, it created tension with a key union. You will clearly need corrections officers to behave differently to get different mental health outcomes from people who are incarcerated in the Bristol County jails. Any concern that that history is going to make it tough for you to get the union and the corrections officers on board for these key changes?
So let me address what you just brought up, because I have to address that now that you raised it. So I had a problem with one union out of my several unions in Attleboro. And in fact, it was just a handful of key people in that union. It wasn't with the actual employees. The union alleged that one particular firefighter should be given injured on duty status. And there was no connection to getting COVID on the job. And so I wasn't listing him as injured on duty. There was no evidence whatsoever. So the union alleged that I withheld benefits, and there were no benefits being withheld. We actually were paying his sick time. We did not cut his medical care as it was alleged. So that was just all, you know, very much not true. So I—
Although none of that was what was in the findings by the Department of Labor Relations.
That actually was in the findings. Everything I just said was part of that. It was.
No, I'm sorry, the negative parts. Right. So the pushback was on your interactions with an individual and a wife.
Yeah. And everything I just said, though, was also part of my testimony before the DLR, which is also part of their write-up because they included my testimony. Yeah. So the wife of a firefighter reached out to me and she basically had said that, you know, I was a terrible person for withholding benefits from this firefighter. And I responded, you know, I'm sorry that you believe the lies of the union president. I was not withholding benefits. So I got dinged on that because I, you know, said that he was lying. And in fact, I demonstrated there was evidence that he was. I'm very clear about what that was. But they said, even though you say that, you showed that, you can't call him a liar. So I got dinged on that. And then the second thing was the fact that I had pointed out that her husband had previously been arrested for domestic violence, and I didn't fire him for that. And I used that as an example to her.
You asked her to consider all of the facts.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I was not trying to stick it to firefighters. I was not trying to give firefighters a hard time. And so in the process of that, you know, the DLR said, well, you know, that could be looked at as coercive. So we're going to ding you on that too. And I said, that's the opposite of coercive. I was actually saying I'm not doing that. So just to be clear, that was the full background of what happened.
So those and all are your that responses is, yeah. there. So now the question is,
yes,
what kind of footing will you be on for reform with officers in the Department of Corrections, you know, with that kind of history out there, just recently that report out there?
Well, I think you're making a hasty generalization that there's a problem with me and unions based on this one thing that happened with this one particular union.
So let me rephrase the question so I can be super clear about this. I don't know your relationship with other unions. I am aware that these kinds of things can be complicating factors. If your answer is, hey, this is not a complicating factor, then that's your answer. But my question is, could this be a complicating factor? And what steps do you take so that you've got a strong alliance in a place where you want to make a lot of really important change?
Well, I just I have a regular monthly meeting with the Correction Officer Union. We have got several unions here, and I've already set up a regular monthly meeting with MCUFU, where we are going to meet once a month to discuss whatever it is that they're interested in talking about. That's something that they haven't had in the past, and we're, you know, MCUFU and I are getting off on a really good foot right now. I mean, we're starting off the right way, and you know, the
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I don't know what the MCUFU, I know that it's an acronym, but I don't know what the MCUFU acronym stands for.
MCUFU is the Mass Correctional Officers Federation Union.
Thank you.
So it's the CO union, and we have a great relationship, and we just started working together, but I think it's going to be a really good one. If you were to talk to the library union or the clerks union or, you know, the police union, I had a very good relationship with all the other unions, the labor union. Any of them could come and approach me at any time. The only one I had a problem with is the firefighter union. And in fairness to me, the previous mayor had the same problems with the same firefighter union. And in fairness to him, the mayor even before him, Judy Robbins, had a problem with the same union. It was the same union officials too. So like I said, I think that you're making a hasty generalization saying that something I had a problem with one person is going to somehow impact what's going on here
in Bristol County. So then I'm going to take your answer as you feel this was a one-off. You don't feel it's going to have any impact on your ability to work with corrections officers, and it shouldn't slow down your reform agenda in that way.
No, not at all. I mean, that's a lot of those guys, you know, I've addressed this with the union. I said, hey, here's the story. And I told them the full story, just like I did with you. Everything I said is in the DLR, you know, document.
So if I'm sounding terse here at the end, I don't mean to. It's just we had a lot to cover, and I do have the rest of the show to go to. Mm-hmm. I am interested in continuing a conversation with you over time, Bristol County Sheriff Paul Heroux, about the reform agenda there. There's a lot of change coming after 25 years under different leadership. I appreciate your time today, and I do hope that you'll come back and join us again.
All right, very good. Thank you.
Thank you. So listening to that conversation, WBUR reporter Deb Becker, who has covered the Ash Street Jail and covered Sheriff Thomas Hodgson, the predecessor to Paul Heroux. Deb, thanks for joining us for a couple minutes.
You're welcome.
So I'm just going to begin by your reactions to what we just heard in that conversation.
Well, he certainly sounds like a very different sheriff in town. I think Sheriff Heroux seems almost the opposite of Sheriff Hodgson. I think most folks will remember that Sheriff Hodgson was very fiery. He said a lot of controversial statements during his time in office and appeared to have a very different philosophy about corrections and about people who are held in custody. For example, during the coronavirus pandemic, Sheriff Hodgson really resisted releasing any people from correctional facilities despite the risk of contracting the virus when we were early on. And he was very angry at the State Supreme Judicial Court for its ruling that said certain people could be released. So that was Sheriff Hodgson. And I think from Sheriff Heroux, what I heard in terms of a focus on programming, which is desperately needed in Massachusetts county jails, and he talked about the demoralizing effects of bad conditions in county correctional facilities. I think that is something that certainly sounds very different for Bristol County, and signing a contract with a suicide prevention expert and hiring a director of inmate services will all be steps that should lead to changes if those things come to fruition.
Do you have any read, and you might not, Deb, at this point, about how hard it is for a sheriff to get the state to bring forward the kind of funding that Heroux would need to close the Ash Street Jail and rehabilitate what he now, originally he was looking at the ICE quarters in the Dartmouth facility. He's now looking at an unused gym. Any read based on your sort of history and corrections reporting with how easy or hard it is to get something like that funded? It's a pretty key piece of what he wants to do.
Right. I think it's unclear at this point because we don't know about the administration of Governor Maura Healey, right? Certainly, we could talk about what happened under former Governor Charlie Baker. He did veto a proposed moratorium on new correctional construction in the state, and that passed the legislature, but Governor Baker did not want that five-year moratorium. And that was something that activists really fought for. They organized hard over plans to replace MCI Framingham, which is even older than the Ash Street Jail, by the way. Also, very bad conditions there, and that's the facility that incarcerates women in Massachusetts. So Governor Baker did not want that moratorium in place. So I think it will be interesting to see. Maura Healey has kept Governor Baker's Secretary of Public Safety and Security, Terrence Reedy. And so how things might change, I think, is still an open question.
All right. WBUR's Deborah Becker joining us from the newsroom in reaction to Sheriff Paul Hureau, who's the new sheriff, with some reform on his mind down in Bristol County. Deb, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
A.J. Greer tied up by Lilligren at the horn for the Boston Bruins in their three-game losing streak.
Well, this is the third consecutive Celtic victory over the Nets as Pritchard hits the three-pointer.
That's what I'm talking about,
yeah.
Baby. Here we go.
WBUR's Chris Siderick there, also here with us in Studio 2, Fluto Shinzawa, who's a senior writer for The Athletic and tells us things, all things Bruins. Hey there, Fluto.
Hi, Tiziana.
And Jonathan Marshall is here because if you haven't figured it out by now, we're doing a sports roundup. Jonathan is on the line from WMUR. Jonathan, welcome back.
What's going on, guys?
All right, so listen, I have to tell all three of you, I am not getting sick of so much winning. I am not tired
spoken
of
spoken like
winning.
A true Bostonian. I love it.
So, Fluto, we're going to start right in with the Bruins. We'll get to the Celtics in just a minute, but I have this question on my mind, and I'm feeling a bit anxious about it at this point, which is there's been so much winning, okay? 39-7 is the Bruins head into the All-Star break. Is that, what does history tell us in such a physical sport? Can they sustain? Because the playoffs don't come until, late April? Can they do this?
There has to be injuries, Tiziana. It's just the nature of the sport.
I feel like a tick-tock in the background.
It's going to happen. So that's one of the challenges that every general manager has is, okay, we just have to acknowledge that players are going to get hurt. And the best way to lead to success is to build as much depth as possible so that when these injuries do take place, that they do have bodies there that are capable of performing at a high level. Now, the issue is cost. Every team is capped at $82.5 million in terms of the salary cap. So the trick for any general manager is to accumulate as many players that can play under that salary cap. It's really tricky. The Bruins are probably going to be over the cap. It's a bit of a technicality, but they can apply some of that difference toward their cap next year. But it's all about this year, right?
You're stressing me out.
That is one of their brightest qualities is that they have depth. They have two excellent goalies. They have two number one defensemen. They have a lot of players on the bench.
Well, I'd love to pick up right there, Fluto, if you don't mind, because I've been dying to ask you the last few times we've done these kind of roundup segments. Linus Ullmark this year has been an unbelievable goalie, but up until this year, he was good, but he was not best in the league level. And I'm just wondering, for a guy to make that kind of leap, is that real? Do you know what I mean? Like, how do you jump that much in your game all of a sudden out of nowhere?
Yeah, it's a great question, Chris, because yes, nobody saw this coming in terms of career history. Projection. Now you thought, okay, this is going to be his second year in Boston. He's going to be more comfortable. He moved in last year during the season. He wasn't happy with his first place in Newton, so he moved mid-season to Brookline. He said he's been a lot happier. His gear is better. He's more comfortable. But he did make
Newton
some technical,
in Brookline yeah. just exploded. Sorry, go ahead.
He made some technical changes to his game. So I think all these things accumulate. Better performance, better technique, just better fit, better comfort. And then the team in front of him is a lot better this year. So it all adds up. But yeah, this has been a pretty significant jump in performance for Linus, and the Bruins are not complaining about that.
Okay, before I turn back to Jonathan Marshall from WMUR and we start talking about the other winningest thing going on out there right now, which is the Celtics, I have one other question for you, Fluto, and it is about the hitting and the punching and the fighting, which used to seem to be a bigger part of Bruins' identity. Chris and I have talked about this a lot. Last year about this time, we talked with a former defenseman, Sean Thornton, who was an enforcer. Here's a little bit from Sean Thornton.
There used to be when I played anyways, three reasons why you would fight. First and foremost, to stick up for your teammate. Secondly, to stick up for yourself. Third, which isn't as common anymore, would be to change the momentum of the game.
So what about the Bruins and the hitting and the punching and the fighting?
And Sean's absolutely correct. There are no players like him left in the league. The Bruins and every other team used to carve out one position specifically for players like Sean. And he would probably take offense to this, but his primary job was to fight.
No, he's admitted that straight up to us when we talked to him.
There are other parts of his game that did make him a critical player. But that was one player on 31 teams that this was their job to fight. Those players are out. It's all about speed, skill. Physicality is still there, but those types of players are just not there. So and then you look at young players coming up. They have no experience in terms of fighting. So yeah, that part has completely dropped off the cliff. There are occasional fights. But yeah, fighting is out.
Okay, so I'm going to turn to you, John, now, because this idea that the game has changed, right? What you want from a player has changed, gives me a chance to bring in the Celtics here, because there's a lot of threes going on. This Celtics team seems to rely really heavily on hitting three-pointers to win. Last night there were, what, Chris, eight straight threes?
Yeah.
So we got the Celtics winning again. They're smoking hot, but they have to hit threes to win. Am I right about that, John?
Yeah, I mean, That's a huge component to their offense. But I will say, having two wing guys in Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum who can break a defense down, and I don't worry so much about Jaylen Brown, more so Jason Tatum, and that's been my concern over the past couple years. And I've seen a sort of a switch, I would say, this year for Tatum, and that when he's locked in and very aggressive and looking to get his offense going, if his shot's not going, I think he's more prone to attack the basket now and use his size and use his skills and his athleticism. So I think if Tatum and Brown continue to have that aggressive mindset and don't fall in love with the three-pointer, I think they'll be okay.
I think, John, you're so right there that in the past we've seen him kind of disengage a little bit when the shot's not falling, and does not seem to be the case anymore. But I just want to take a minute and revel in the success that was last night, and just let's give folks a little bit of a sample of what that sounded like.
Jason, three. What are we watching?
Okay, three.
Here? 5 for 5, shooting threes. Tatum from the corner this time.
Oh, man. Tatum looks like he's out there practicing.
Yes, he does. Pull up.
Wow.
Wow. You're going to get a chance to score here soon.
I love it. Mike Gorman said even Brian Scalabrine is going to get a shot to score there. We've been talking about the Celtics' biggest opponent is themselves, right? Like, they just need to kind of keep doing what they do. When they are hitting on all cylinders, I don't think there's a team in this league that can stop them. And that's what you saw a little bit of last night. They just made it look so easy, so smooth, so fluid, and just kind of showed you the kind of scoring power that they have and the depth on this team.
Which raises the other question that I was curious to ask both of you about, and John, I'll turn to you first on this, which is this idea of maturity. I remember so clearly a year ago, maybe right around this time, there was a lot of question about, are these players, we know they're talented enough, are they mature enough? And the thought was they weren't, but the coaching was. So now we have this very different situation on our hands this year, which is we have a young replacement coach in Joe Mazzulla, and we have these players that I feel like everybody's talking about with a kind of confidence. So what's changed? Have they just grown up in the spotlight, John, or is it a different coach? Am I making things up and it's neither of the above?
No, I think the maturation process, right? And we've talked about it before, this, especially the group of Marcus Smart, Jaylen Brown, and Jason Tatum, they're still pretty young, right? They're not even in their 30s, but they've been through these playoff battles over the years. They've been through, especially in the NBA, you can see when it comes to certain teams and stars, there are stages that you have to reach, right? You'll lose in early rounds. You'll make the Eastern Conference Finals. You'll stumble along the way, then you reach the finals, and then there's that one extra hump you have to get over. So there's stages that these guys have been through already. And we've seen the coaching situation this year from Ime Udoka to Joe Mazzulla, the way that they've been able to handle that, the locker room issues last year, and just having internal meetings and trying to figure things out. I think last year's turnaround and to make it to the finals, I think that did a lot when it comes to their growth and their maturation process. So I think the natural step right now, when you hear the conversation about this team, it's finals or bust. There's no excuse right now. And that's just the expectation of having that experience and growing mentally and just growing as a team and having that chemistry at this point.
So, Chris Sidorek, pick it back up there from Jonathan Marshall.
Yeah, I think he hit it right on the head, especially at the end. That run last year to get so close to winning a title and then to fail – You kind of could see it in the team's leaders, Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, in the offseason. They just got to work, right? And that's everything from conditioning to, shooting practice. Every little piece of footage we saw of them kind of working out looked like they were seriously getting down to business. And I think that is a function of getting so close, tasting it, but not walking away with it, right? And so that hunger, fueling that hunger of we're going back and we're getting that because that championship is ours. I think that's what you're seeing here, and that's what it takes to kind of take teams to that next level.
Okay, so I want to bring Fluto Shinzawa of The Athletic back in here for a second before we go to the question of the retirement, which we'll get to in a second. But before we do, Fluto, you talked with the Bruins about the strength of the bench, right? And I have been struck with the strength of the Celtics bench as well. And I want to ask, sort of rapid fire, all three of you, is that why these teams are they were good last year? But is that why they're magnificent in a different way? Fluto for the Bruins?
Yeah, I think so, Tiziana. Just because, okay, Linus Allmark, he needs a night off. Jeremy Swayman comes right in. He's been terrific. He had some peaks and valleys earlier, but he's been really consistent back to his game. So that's their in goal. On defense, they have a regular NHL defenseman in Mike Riley buried in the minors right now, just because, okay, there's some cap issues there, but he is not as good as the six players who they have in front of him. One young guy, Jakub Zboril, he's played one game in probably the last 30 games just because he can't get in. Same thing up front. They've been without Jake DeBrusk for about a month here. They've been fine. So, yeah, that's just such a luxury for a coach to have so many options because, okay, let's face it, you're David Pastrnak isn't going to be scoring three goals every game, but when he's not, they can roll out Pavel Zacha, Taylor Hall, Charlie Coyle, and they're just fine.
All right, 30 seconds on this to you, Jonathan Marshall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the Celtics have depth at the most important position. That's at the point guard position. Marcus Smart has been out, right? So when you can lean on, hey, Malcolm Brogdon, who has been a starter throughout his career, he's coming off their bench, and also a Derek White as well. So they have multiple ball handlers and creators, which is so huge in the NBA. So they have the luxury of a Marcus Smart, Brogdon, Derek White, Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown. These are like a handful of guys who can just take it, attack, and create for others. That's a luxury that not many teams in the NBA have. So they have depth, but they have depth at the right position.
All right.
It's part of human nature. You ask a little less of us, right? You're able to kind of meet the moment even better. You're able to rise to the occasion. I think that's what you're seeing.
Okay, I mean, we got like 3 minutes, so we got to talk about Tom Brady retiring. And Chris, I'm going to turn to you on this because there's a little dribble of some news coming out of CNN about Robert Kraft.
Yeah, so Robert Kraft was on CNN this morning saying basically he's going to do everything in his power.
Owner of the New England Patriots.
Yes, of course. Sorry, I assume everybody is up on that. Yeah, he's going to do everything in his power to get Tom Brady to sign a one-day contract and retire as a Patriot. I really do hope that this comes to fruition because I think one thing that we missed in the Tom Brady era was a chance to basically celebrate just an unprecedented career level of success. Because when he came back to Gillette last year, or 2021, excuse me, there was the unspoken tension of we want to celebrate you, but you're coming in with another team. I mean, listen to what it sounded like on NBC Sunday Night Football.
Here comes Mr. Robert Kraft, owner of the Patriots. A lot of history between these two right here.
A lot of success, great success between those two. But it's interesting how Mr. Kraft is sitting here talking to the quarterback who's going to try to dismantle his team later on this evening.
And I was in the stadium covering this game for the station, and there was this tension of, yay, you're back, we love you, but also we want to beat you, right? So to have his moment where we can really just truly celebrate the unprecedented success would be, I think, great for everyone.
Okay, so Jonathan Marshall, I'm a WMUR. I'm going to put a target on my back here. So I'm going to say, I get the hoopla. I think I believe him that he's really retiring. I think it's beautiful that he has a chance potentially to retire as a Patriot. But do I have to like him? Because I'm not sure I like the guy very much. But I'm also not sure that really matters.
I noticed you asked the Philadelphia guy this question.
I did. Yeah, not you, Chris.
I mean, I have no issue with Brady. One of my favorite Brady moments. Look, Chris, I told you I wouldn't bring it up, so I'm just leave it alone. I'll leave it alone. But look, everything that Brady was able to do as a New England Patriot I mean, he did some great things, right? And so I think there's a certain level of appreciation, even all throughout this season when it comes to talking about the Patriots. What was the question? Is it Belichick or was it Brady, right? And so that right there just shows you the level of greatness and just all that he was able to achieve during his time. And so, I mean, you kind of, you may not have to like him, but there has to be a respect and appreciation level there, I would say.
So, Fluto Shinzawa, I'm going to give you 10 seconds on this. You're so hockey. Do you care? Is this one that transcends?
I think, TCN, what's always been interesting is that you look at some of the best hockey players, Zdeno Chara, Patrice Bergeron, Tuukka Rask, who have accomplished great things, and they all looked up to Tom Brady and said, whoa, this guy's won 6 titles, this, that. They've been, he's so competitive, he's so good, he's such at the top of his game. So that was really interesting to see elite athletes looking up at a player like Tom Brady.
Nice. And on that note, Fluto Shinzawa of The Athletic, Jonathan Marshall of WMUR, Chris Siderick of WBUR. Really fun to wrap up the sports. Lots more to watch for. Thanks to all three of you.
Always pleasure. A blast.
Thank you.
The pick is in, and you guys were both right. It is indeed Henry Hislop. Oh, celebrations with him and his family. 6th overall, he'll be a member of the New England Revolution as he begins his pro career.
And that was ESPN 2020 Henry Kessler, drafted to play professional soccer. And that was a dream that he had been working toward. And when I say working, I mean working toward, since he was about 12. He took the field that first year with dogged determination, a lot of talent, and some fiery spark. Here's NBC Sports Boston that September.
Wins delivery. It drops dangerously. Kessler stings it, and the rookie has his first Major League Soccer goal.
And you can see the boys are hyped. They're happy for the young Henry Kessler, who's worked tirelessly to make an impact in this match.
Now, the Revs headed off to training camp last weekend, but before they boarded the plane, Henry Kessler came to Studio 2, and we talked about both his career and the beautiful game. So Monday, we brought you the career part. Part one of that conversation, his 5-hour commutes to and from training at 12 years old, his love of the grind. So today, part two, where he teaches us about the beautiful game itself. For example, pretty easy, as we just heard, to recognize greatness if someone scores. But what about seeing greatness in more subtle parts of the play?
Sent forward into the open field for Kiza. Kiza, prolific scorer, held off the ball by Henry Kessler.
So when we sat down with Henry Kessler, he actually embraced this opportunity to help us understand what's happening on the field. And that's especially valuable for those of us who maybe started to fall in love with soccer a little during the World Cup and want to be ready for when that World Cup arrives in Boston in 2026. Henry started by telling us the most basic thing, other than watching the ball, you know, of course, that someone who wants to start loving the game could watch for on the field.
I think the is how teams move. You know, I think that generally will give you an understanding. So, like, I'll make an analogy to American football. It's very structured. So you see teams move 10 yards at a time, generally. Soccer is a little bit more fluid. So
just a little.
Yeah, yeah. So you get a better idea of, like, not only where the ball is, but where the team is. So if everyone's in one half, you know, generally that means the attacking team is in a favorable position and vice versa. So I would say look where the players are, not just where the ball is. That would be my first bit of advice. But you hit the nail on the head. What I don't understand, I enjoy less too. And yeah. I think there are nuances in every sport that you know, I only understand in my sport, and I try to watch other sports and gather this stuff, but what you don't understand, I think you enjoy less. So
there was a moment as I was preparing to talk with you today. So I was looking at I was on YouTube and I'm looking at, you know, highlight reels and film mm-hmm. of you playing and that kind of thing. Two things that I noticed. One, not at all surprising, which is despite the fact that you're a defensive player for the New England Revolution, many of the highlights are when you've scored,
okay.
right? And that's because everybody knows that that's success, right? We all know what it means when the ball goes in the net or through the goalposts or whatever that, you know. But the other thing was, there was one video, it's from a 2019 game, you were still in college, and it is a compilation of all your plays in that game.
I think I've actually seen this one.
This is the one against Pacific.
It's yeah.
20, right. Okay, so here's the thing. I'm watching the 7 minutes, right? And I know you're an elite player. So there are things I know I must be seeing that are amazing, that's excellence. But I don't know how to see it because I don't know what you're doing. So if somebody's watching you achieve excellence as a defender, What do they look for to see that excellence unfolding on the field? Do you understand my question?
I understand. It's generally really small things, so it's hard to it's harder for the average person to analyze a defender than an attacker. An attacker, you do something good, it's obvious.
Right.
A defender, you do something good, it's maybe not so obvious. But I tell my teammates this all the time. It's the little plays that make me so happy. So, for instance, like, oh, I made someone play a backwards pass. That's a W.
Somebody has to pass the ball behind them.
Exactly. So I'm defending a striker, attacker, winger, whoever, and they play the ball backwards towards their own net. That's a good play.
See, and I can look for that.
You can look for that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Give me a couple others.
Yeah, if I force someone backwards, even if I kick a ball out of bounds, if they're attacking and I kick it out, that might be a good clearance.
Why?
Just it. They can't score from the stands. You know,
you kind of get a re-hit.
Yeah. If the ball is in the stands, they can't score. That's why.
Okay.
I'm trying to think a few. Oh, and if I'm on the ball
and
I pass the ball forward, it could be a short pass. It could be a longer pass. If it's a forward completed pass, that's a good play.
Yeah.
Because I'm getting the ball closer to the opposition's net.
What is your favorite thing that you're good at?
I'm going to. Two categories, attacking, defending. I'm going to go defending. I'm a defender. I take pride in that. I think I'm someone who's hard to play against. So I think if you asked opposing strikers, they'd be like, yeah, that guy's really annoying. You know, he's a pain. And I think that's probably what brings me the most joy is being a pain to other players.
And why are you a pain? Because you're in their way? Because you're stealing the ball a lot? Because you're trash talking? I mean, what's making you so annoying?
I think
happily annoying.
Yeah, right. I'm physical, so like there's a lot off the ball that happens that maybe the camera doesn't pick up, but like the ball's out of the play, push, you know, like shove, whatever. Get it kind of like
Henry.
There's always contact.
Yeah.
There's always contact. So, you know, stuff like that. Yeah.
All right. So a couple other things now. I feel like I've learned. I'm going to go try this, right?
Okay.
You've given me some things to watch for. I'm going to go try this. And I'm actually, the first thing I'm going to do is go back to your 7 minutes and watch for these little things that you've just told me about. And I bet you I'll see all of them.
Great.
Right in that 7 minutes. All right. So a couple of other things. I want to talk World Cup.
Yeah.
And I want to talk both what it must feel like to have the pinnacle of your sport coming home in 2026 and in your secret, deepest place of what you want, what is your dream about what happens for you in 2026?
So I'll answer the first part, which is the World Cup coming back to the U.S. You know, my parents, I don't think I was, what was it, 94?
Yeah.
When it was last in the U.S.?
I think that's right.
I wasn't alive. My parents told me they attended. Great, was great for the sport. It actually kind of created MLS 2 years later.
Major League Soccer?
Yeah. So it had an immense effect the first time it was here. I can't imagine the effect it'll have next time. So I know it's going to be in three countries, U.S., Canada, and Mexico. I think that's going to be great too, just, you know, get different venues. But if it created a league the last time it was here, I can't imagine what it'll do this time. So I'm really excited. I think it'll grow the sport even more, and I think the sport is continuing to grow here. And so I'm really excited for that. And then secondly, on a personal note, I hope I'm a part of it, obviously. I've only played for the U.S. twice, so hope to add to those appearances. I hope I'm starting. You know, the whole lot, everything you can imagine I'm hoping for. And I'm not just hoping, I'm also working towards.
So just for our listeners to get a sense of this, you were the overall number six draft pick in 2020.
Yeah.
And for those of you who don't know how a draft works, that's good, right, first. And second, you start regularly. I think I wrote this down, last year in 2022, you had 22 appearances and started 21 times.
Yeah.
So you are a starter who is very good at your sport. So these are, and we've already established that you will work your fingers to the bone, right? So these feel like things that could really happen. So what's the end, right? And you're only 24. You can play for a really long time, right? And who knows if, I doubt there are many Tom Brady's who play till 45 in professional soccer, right? But is there ever a moment where you're like, yeah, I've done it all. I'll be done.
I don't know, because there's still, like, there's a lot that I want to accomplish. So obviously I've mentioned stuff for the national team, which I'm still on the outside looking in. You know, they just played a game the other day against Serbia, and I'm here. I'm not there. So I'm still on the outside looking in, trying to work towards being there whenever there's an opportunity.
Is that hard or is that motivating?
It's both.
It's both.
It's both. Because, like, part of me, you know, knows I can do better. And then there's also a part of me thinking, like, maybe you could be there right now,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
So it's both. But definitely motivating. But I'm also happy that I have teammates there. You know, DeJuan Jones, teammate of mine with the Revs, is there, and I'm really happy for him. Got his first appearance, so congrats to him. But yeah, it's both. And then in terms of club soccer, there's a lot that I want to accomplish too. I want to win MLS Cup with the Revs. There are different leagues that I want to play in. You know, MLS is, it's different than these other sports where it's clear that the U.S. is the pinnacle of the sport. That's not necessarily the case here. So there's, I want to play in Europe. I want to play in different countries, have different experiences, and you only have so much time to do it. So
it's a busy agenda.
It's a busy agenda. There's a lot I need to get to and not a lot of time.
All right, one more trivia question.
Okay.
Because I just want to know. So when the articles reported on you playing for the U.S. team, they said something about you're wearing the cap. What does that mean?
Okay, yeah, let me explain. So I think it goes back a long time to history/tradition, where when you got an appearance for your national team, you received a cap. You received a physical cap. Now it's just a term.
Okay, so no one gives you a hat.
Yeah, no one gives me a hat.
God, it kind of seems like they could afford to give you a hat.
Yeah, I kind of want a hat,
yeah.
You know, now that you say it. But no, so it's just called, so instead of an appearance, it's literally called a cap for the national team.
Got it.
So I have two caps because I've played two games for the U.S.
You have two caps and you have zero caps.
And I have zero caps, yeah.
Okay. All right, so last thing. I want to pick a little bit of a fight here, Henry. You're from New York.
Yeah.
And you're in Boston. And yeah, I wish listeners could see the look on your face right now. It's like, I don't even have to finish the question. So are you, you know, learning to love the Boston? I'm sure you love the Revolution, and I'm not going to ask you to say anything else, right? But are you learning to love the Boston teams, or are you just disguising your New York passion?
It's a bit of both. A bit of both. So the Celtics recently hosted me at a game.
How did that feel?
It felt great. And so I sat second row. You know, I felt like a high roller. So I was really excited. They played the Warriors too, so it was a great game, you know, overtime win. So I was very thankful
well,
to be there.
That was a good game.
A fantastic game.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So I was very thankful that, you know, I got to go to that game. I've been to several Red Sox games, and that's the team I cannot root for. That is the team. So I grew
Are
up
Are you Yankees or
I'm
Mets?
A Yankees fan.
You're,
I'm a Yankees fan.
Out. Go. Where this interview is done. We're done.
And that's the one team I can't get behind. So the Pats, we share a stadium. You know, I've met some of them.
Yeah.
All great guys. So I'm rooting for them, too. I'm not huge on football, but, you know, I've kind of adopted the Pats. Celtics hosted me, as I said. Bruins, I would love to get to a game. Haven't been to a game yet, so I'm hoping to do that.
This would be the year.
They're doing great, right?
Yep.
But no, the Red Sox, that's the one team I cannot root for. Yeah, and it's
tough. Well, in all fairness, right now there are a lot of Red Sox fans themselves who are feeling that way. So we'll just leave it at that. Henry Kessler is a defensive player. He's a center back for the New England Revolution. What a delight. Thank you for coming in. So nice to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me. Nice to meet you as well.
Good luck with the season.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, Rob Lane, and Sydney Bowles, with help from Tyra Brooks. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Folladoon is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.